the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys over here on my right. We've got Bobby Sommerfeld, engineer extraordinaire.
That's me, Mikey. You remember that. Yeah, my mate.
Bobby, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
Next to him, we've got Mr. Rhythm himself, Forrest Robinson.
Even the wildfires in Altadena can't keep me from you, Mike. You and the brothers.
And across the table, we've got Bill Burgess, who is not only a great synth player, but he is also a fine drummer himself, as we found out.
Not even the wildfires in Glendale keep me away from you, Mike.
And next to him, we've got programmer extraordinaire, synth, and software guru, Rob Arbiter.
Hello, Mike. And
sushi guru.
Sushi guru now.
And massive gear hog, as it turns out.
Massive gear hog, and I can see the fire in the distance, and I hope it stays that way.
You didn't care about our plight. You were in your studio. You didn't care.
I cared. I didn't know it was your plight, but I did.
Fire.
Well, in case anybody wants to know what the big topic's around here is, there's been fire in Southern California in the Los Angeles area, and actually it's affected a couple of people. And you know what? We're going to just start talking about that right now. Bill, you got evacuated, and I know your studio, you had to tear down your studio, and I know Forrest, you had some evacuation too.
Yeah.
But let's start with you, Bill, really quick. How was it when you had to, you know, tell us about your experience and about tearing down your studio and about what kind of, you know, how do you make those choices and those decisions?
Well, I mean, we had a little bit of time because they had an evacuation zone that was five blocks from my house for 2 days. And then it came to the phone call at 2 a.m, LA County Sheriff, mandatory evacuations. And so I didn't think it would come at night. I'm like, dudes, do that in the daytime. But it came right at 2 a.m. So what happened was I had to get everything, all the family stuff, all the studio stuff. I spent most of my time in the studio, actually.
Leave the kids for shoes.
And then the crazy thing is at 4:30 a.m, then it get another call from 911 saying the evacuation zone is now evacuation zone is now one block away. So I packed it all up, only to have to not go, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. And then everything stayed in our car until about 4 this afternoon.
Wow.
And just a half hour, or just coming down here, they said that Glendale is finally in the mop-up stage.
Wow.
This thing was roiling, man. It was just crazy. I have not ever seen anything like this.
Well, I was on the freeway, on the 2 freeway, and I pulled off, and it was literally you look to the left and you just see fire as far as you can see, and you look to the right and you see fire as far as you can see. It was amazing.
The face of the fire along the 210 was 16 miles long.
Wow. That's incredible.
Insane. So anyway,
16 miles long.
16 miles and 19 deep. And now it's doubled.
Yeah.
We sit there out the windows, and we have a Jetsons type of house that's got the big triangle roof that you can see way up. And we look up steep mountains, and oh my gosh, it's just roiling for day after day after day, and then heavy smoke in the morning.
Scary.
But packing the studio was not as hard because I have four sliding glass doors in my studio,
right.
And they form two airlocks. Well, that first airlock has got my three towers and all my drives in one spot. And I was always thinking earthquake. I never thought fire.
Right.
So I was able to go in and just snatch the three towers, snatch all the drives, and I have this. Actually, it turns out that having road cases from my drumming days saved it all. So I've got these big
flight cases.
Mm-hmm. You just packed it all in there.
And I put all my toms and bass drums and stuff in them, and I just open them up and just start laying them in. And then my main tower went into a Pelican, my iLock,
save the iLock.
And everything just went right into that main Pelican. And I shut it down, and I thought, that is crazy. The essence of my whole life is right in that box.
Wow. Now, let me ask you a question. When you evacuate in a quick situation like that, it seems to me like I would leave all the cables there because you can always buy cables. You just take the main machines and you take all the hard drives. But, I mean, did you just leave all your looms, everything there? And you just
grabbed it? Because that stuff is going under the floor. It's right. In. It's like you guys' studio. It's there. It'd take a while. I left speakers. I left screens. I left keyboards. I happen to have all my discs and all my NFRs and everything in a brief couple of Vanvil briefcases already. And so that was easy.
That's smart that you're already planning for that kind of thing, because that helps you prepare for, you know, you never know what's going to happen. Forrest, did you have to, you know, tear down any of your gear or?
You know, and I'll be honest with you, I've been in a daze ever since. I think like right now I'm understanding the trauma is trauma.
Traumatic.
So, I mean, the mandatory evacuations first off are two blocks up from us. I live in Altadena. Where this main sort of artery, Loma Alta, that's sort of like where the mountains are, where the hiking trails are, and we're literally like only a couple blocks away. So my wife, being the incredible administrator and preparations person, camper, you know, youth counselor that she's been, we weren't going to wait until someone came knocking on our door.
Right.
So here I am in a daze, right, grabbing two consoles, a MIDI controller. And honestly, I kind of felt a little silly in a way, because we had all these things that were really important to us. And, you know, and I should have logged everything. So anyone out there listening, grab a document, anything you have that labels any of your gear. Start looking it up and insure it. I definitely put in for AAA insurance that, you know, I have gear, but I realize how grossly I underestimated the value of what I have.
Right.
And then a good friend of mine called up, bass player, was like, hey, man, I'm coming over with my SUV. God bless, you know, Sean Beal for that. So I got out, like, my Gretsch kits. Got three kits. And then I'm like, okay, well, I'm getting ready to start doing some drum therapy work at a hospital on Rancho Cucamonga. So, okay, well, let me go ahead and get that. But it really took my wife, God bless her, who was like, okay, well, you do need some tools to work with and everything. So, yeah, why don't you and Sean go ahead and get your, you know, start working on your gear. I'll work on the documents and the deed and the IRS stuff and, you know, and we'll try to get scrap booklets and trying to think of what we can leave behind. Here I am looking at gear though, and that's my life,
right.
You know,
right.
And I'm legitimate. You know, it's a legitimate thing. But then my wife is looking at heirlooms and things like this, and it just, my stuff seemed to pale in comparison.
Wow.
You know, so I'm kind of dealing with that still, but it puts everything into perspective. And the beautiful thing, I stood up in church like on Sunday and I just simply said, you know, beautiful thing out of this, I see my community looking like and acting like a community, more. And, you know, music is going to be really important here.
Right.
For everybody that's been through that and everyone that has been through that before, right now I'm really thinking about what can I do with my gear and my gifts to hopefully, I don't know, man, I might even have to crash a couple firehouses or something because a couple firefighters die. I pray that nothing else will happen. Yeah. I'm concerned about the communities and it's going to be really, I think it's going to be really important, even more important now.
I think the one thing is, and the reason why I wanted these guys to talk about the fire was, you know, we take for granted our studios and where we work and the tools that we use. And you never know when you're going to have an Altadena fire or you're going to have a Hurricane Katrina. And I think people just have to be prepared for, you know, tornadoes in the Midwest and just, you know, be prepared to do something with your studio, whether you leave it there or
right.
You take your hard drives. I mean, Rob,
I'm definitely ready for a hurricane. That's about the only one I'm ready for.
Dude, it'll take you a year to get out of your place.
Do you have like, if we have the big one hits? I mean, I know your stuff is pretty secure, you know, installed, but I mean,
I've come up with a plan where I'm going to basically suffer like everyone else. That's the plan. I mean, you do what you can.
Right.
But, no, if I had to actually evacuate the place, I have no idea what I would do.
I mean, it would take 10 guys 2 days to get your place out.
I don't think you'd ever know.
No, you couldn't evacuate that. No.
Grab a floppy disk and head out.
Here's what was crazy.
Grab a floppy and hope for the best.
Yeah.
I realized that I'd had a lot of documentation of my stuff, but not recently. So there I am at 2:30 in the morning, and I'm taking pictures of every rack, taking pictures of every drawer. I'm taking pictures of software on the shelves.
I hear you, brother.
I'm taking pictures of all of it. And in the end, I have two drum kits and several snare drums and, you know, probably 50 cymbals. And I took two cymbals, my 60s 22A Zildjian and my mid-80s K. And I took my 64 Ludwig snare. And then the rest of it, I figure I could replace it.
Wow.
But the thing is I used to carry music insurance. And I kind of, I year after year, I would carry, you know, by the insurance. And I got the idea that it was like just a couple of guys on a 1-800 number that were just taking my money.
Right.
I mean, they were very disorganized. And so a couple of years back, I dropped that. But man, you know, I've got three flat panel displays and three towers, on and on and on and on. And I don't know. I have to ask you guys, like, in days past, if you had the kind of gear that we have in an ordinary house, your insurance company would just...
I have special insurance. I've got it through the union. I've had it for 12 years or so, and I upgrade it every year. In fact, I've got an Excel sheet about 4 or 5 pages
long. See, I used to do the same thing, yeah. And it was through ASCAP.
It may be through ASCAP too.
You're through musicians.
Local 47.
Local 47, exactly.
Okay.
And it's been, I mean, I've had it, I've always had it. I've had it literally for about 12, 14 years because I got hit in the earthquake in 1994. I had a studio at home. I was in the middle of a mix. I think maybe I even told you the story, but either way, I was in the middle of a mix at about 2 a.m. I quit because I was tired. I had the DAT in pause record, and I said, hey, I'll print it in the morning. And we had an earthquake at 4:31, and that studio never, ever worked again, ever.
Oh, my gosh.
That whole console got toasted. A Genelec went right across one side of the studio and smashed right into the TT patch band, broke like everything in it. And
wow. It was like
24 track, the Elko had wires hanging out of it.
Were you insured at the time?
I was insured at the time, yeah.
See, I used to carry, I was the same. I carry insurance until about 3 years ago and road insurance for being out on tour.
Yeah.
And I had all that, and I don't know what happened. I mean, most of my stuff is NFR now, like, it's been given to me, and I'm like, well, I just back off on the insurance. But so I was uploading these pictures to my iDisk while I'm packing.
So you literally go somewhere else.
Because I was thinking, what if it all did burn to the ground? I mean, literally. What if it got trapped in the car going out?
I mean, it's a whole other question that enters my mind when I've been there as well. Where I go, well, you know, so I have my life in this box. This mix of means a lot to me. My old Moogs, we all got our stuff that we think mean a lot, and your heirlooms and everything. But then you go, hey, you know something, we're all going to go out in a box anyway. So basically, you know, just pick up what you really think is important.
It definitely brought some things in perspective.
Definitely.
But
I think it's useful in a way, a little bit.
It's amazing. And I've been cathartic. It's hard to concentrate this whole week.
Oh, dude,
I've been so grumpy without my tower, without my stuff up in my studio. Man, hard to live with.
I know that my things, my gear has gained a lot of value.
Right.
And I'm not complaining about it. So, you know, and I'm praying that things do settle because there are a lot of surrounding communities that are very troubled right now. But, you know, I don't believe I'm going to go. I didn't realize I was taking things for granted. You know, of course we do, you know, these things happen.
Right.
It's not like it's personal. It just kind of happens.
Right.
But it's good to have something to snap you out of that.
Yeah,
yeah.
Bobby, do you have an evac plan for your studio?
Yes. Yeah, I have.
What would you grab?
The nice thing about my place is all my stuff is still in flight cases, and I have all the lids, so it's essentially a load up and close up sort of thing. So it would take me about, without the console, I couldn't get the console out. I'd have to leave all the cabling in the wall, of course.
Right.
And the tower, I'd most probably need to get out. I'd need a U-Haul truck. I'd most probably get it out in about 6 hours, I suppose, 7 hours. Mm. You know, from roadie days, I mean, it's just a matter of, the whole console's all Elcos, you know, it's old analog console. Mm. And everything else is Elcos, so I just pull it and leave all that in the ground. I mean,
wow.
Where else? I've also got a power generator, actually, my house.
Because
in the earthquake, you get a quick lesson of, hey, don't be stupid.
You know, one thing I would suggest, too, is I've been looking into this for my own stuff, is, you know, some type of offsite backup or some type of online offsite backup, too, especially some of the new stuff like Carbonite, which is all encrypted. And you can have unlimited amount of data that they'll store for you. You know, and it's $50 a year. That's just cheap insurance.
Okay,
for
it. I'm sorry. This is new. Can you elaborate on Carbonite?
Carbonite, it's $50 a year. Mm-hmm. And basically, you have an account and you upload to their servers. And it's encrypted, so only you have access to your data. And it's an unlimited amount of data if you want to upload. It's not fast, so, you know, it's not like you're going to do gigs a minute or anything like that.
Sure.
But, you know, if you need a place to put those masters or put those recordings or you're in a work in progress, you leave it running overnight and you have it backed up off-site. And it's, you know, and if something happens to your computer, you have it backed up.
It's wicked. Yeah.
And all you need to do is download the client and you can download it back to whatever computer. And for $50 a year, that is just
that's pretty happening.
I was going to charge you $50 a store and $3,000 to download it back.
What they do is they give you a 30-day free trial, right? Mm. So you upload all this stuff.
Yeah, and then what are you going to do?
Then what are you going to do?
And then they hope for a crash.
Yeah. So then, and you want to get your data back, then you become a subscriber. But seriously, though, $50 is nothing. That is compared to the value of your data.
That's true.
I just wanted to, you know, talk about this with the guys, A, because they just looked like they needed that kind of therapy right now.
We did. Thank you, Mike.
And B, you know what? Things like this just put a lot of things in perspective, but you just, you know, it doesn't hurt to do a little bit of planning.
I think it's also good to be grateful for the firefighters that obviously two people lost their lives, but the hard work those guys do, guys and girls. I mean,
that's crazy.
That's
scary,
amazing.
Scary gig that is.
They are sleeping.
They're
literally
bored. They're bored 90% of the year, like catatonic bored, and then the other 10% is sheer
panic. It's like flying.
Yeah. They're flying.
That's crazy.
Hours of boredom in between.
And they're literally sleeping on the street around their trucks when they get a chance to sit down or whatever. So it's definitely not a comfort zone, even for the folks who are out there and they have a break. They're laying on the streets.
Well, let's, you know, give a cheer to firefighters. Yay,
yes!
Firefighters! All right. Well, now let's move on to a little bit more reality.
That is reality. Yeah.
A different type of reality.
How about a nicer reality?
A nicer reality, sure.
On this show, we're going to answer some of the listener questions that we have out there because we're really bad at that sometimes. And I apologize to the people that have sent in questions and haven't
– Gee, Mike.
Well, we started talking, and I was going to answer the question at the end of the podcast, and we like keep putting it off.
Actually, Forrest and I were about ready to cry about this together, and now we're going to answer questions.
All right, if you could think of a better segue.
No, that's right.
Actually, I know something. Carry on. Sorry.
No, go ahead. You started.
And I just thought of something real, an important thing, something maybe be able to pick up from the fire and audio related thing. One thing I did buy from a firefighter told me to get is a special fire extinguisher for your recording studios. I don't know if you guys know, but you can't just spray any old sort of extinguisher on your equipment if you have a fire.
Right.
Like a small fire, like your waste paper basket blows up or something like that, whatever. You can actually do more damage with a fire extinguisher putting out the fire than actually the fire itself.
Right.
So you should look online, and I can't remember for the life of me what the chemical is, but it's a special like HO2 kind of.
Is it halon or halon?
I think it is. Is it halon?
Yeah. Where basically it robs the
air of oxygen.
Right, it kills everyone in the room, too.
Right, it's fine. But then at that stage, as long as the mix is okay, you don't really care about the people.
No, that's true, though. They work really good. I had a small studio where I had one in there until there was, like, big environmental concerns and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But they work great. If you've ever seen a demo of those fire extinguishers,
they're
amazing. This one guy had a wood maze and a fire at one end, and there was a cover on it with air getting through, and he sprayed it here, and it ate up all the air all the way, and it put the fire out.
They used to use it in, like, computer data centers and stuff, but the problem is it really would theoretically kill the people.
Right.
Because it'd suck all the oxygen out of the room.
Oh, lovely.
I had a fire in a studio once. Walked in, and the whole ceiling was on fire.
Really?
Yeah. But the fire department came.
Wow.
I still have plastic drips on my stick bag.
I was doing a gig.
Man.
I was drum teching for Striper, and we were playing this little club.
Striper?
Yeah. Awesome. That was like my first road gig.
The Soldiers Under Command tour or something?
No, it was actually against the law.
Against the law. So we Striper gone bad.
We were in somewhere in the South, and their lighting rig consisted of a homemade board with a bunch of dimmers that you buy at like
like Home Depot or something?
Yeah. Oh, so just imagine a big board with like 16 of these dimmers.
When the budget was listening and rock and roll.
And then they had yellow extension cords up the ceiling all the way over to the stage.
Wow.
And there was like at least 16 extension cords, right? I mean, it was as low tech as you can get. Well, when they were hooking up the power, somebody hooked something else wrong, and all of a sudden you hear this and it was like a fuse. It followed one of those extension cords all the way back down to the dimmer. Caught it on fire. Everybody had to evacuate.
That's lovely. Just as well, man, the guitar. Can you imagine the guitar tech?
You just reminded me of the most dangerous. Have I talked about this on a previous podcast? There's been so many. The most dangerous product I ever saw at a NAMM show.
What was that?
Did we ever talk about this?
Who knows?
No, but I have a feeling you're about to, and I'm going to love it.
It's hilarious. This guy had come up with an adapter that would adapt. It went from XLR to like a three-prong electrical plug with the idea being that you could use like a lawnmower extension cord as an extended mic cable.
That's awesome.
Everybody was gathered around the booth just wanting to see how long it would take for someone to just plug a microphone into the wall, into wall power.
Yeah.
But that's what it was. It was XLR to grounded three-pin AC plug.
No.
And I thought that is singularly the most dangerous product I've ever seen
in
my life.
Classic.
Can you imagine?
I could see so many places where I could go wrong.
The 58, plug the 58 in here and then plug
into the wall. Exactly.
How to kill your lead singer.
I'll never forget that. But the idea of having all those yellow extension cords up the ceiling.
It was probably the same guy.
Could have been the same guy. They could have, and half of them are mic lines and half of them are 120 volts.
Wow. That's crazy.
And then you have to keep track of which is which.
See? And this is why we don't answer.
Hey, at least it's
funny. What happens when
at least it's funny. Now let's answer some questions.
All right. Well,
do we have any questions?
We do, actually. And I want to.
What's a good way of extending a mic cable?
I can tell you the worst. If someone said, I want to extend a mic cable in the worst way, it's like, well, here's the worst way.
I like risk.
Okay, our first question that we're going to tackle, actually a set of questions, is from someone named Lee Pierce, who emailed us and also posted these on our Facebook page. And they're pretty good questions, actually, so we're going to take each one at a time. The first thing he wants to know is he wanted to know – we talk a lot about plus 4 and minus 10 when recording, and he wants to know – what we mean. And the way he says it is also just wondering, when you guys talk about plus 4 and minus 10 and everything when recording, what do you guys mean?
We mean don't use minus 10.
I know my mixer has 28 dB of headroom, but how does that work in the digital domain? And how do you guys calculate SPL using a meter? So, Bobby?
It's a question for Forrest, really.
Yeah. It sounds good. It is good.
Anybody want to answer?
I can answer if you like.
Yes.
Yeah, do the entertaining plus 4 minus 10. Yeah.
Okay, very good then.
That's a good one.
Very good then.
Well, to answer your question about minus 10, minus 10 and plus 4, basically, from an analog standpoint, there are two reference levels, or let's call it voltage levels, for want of a better word now. So plus 4 is normally 4 dB, which is a ratio measurement above 0. So essentially, if 0 is, let's call 0 that full scale deflection on your meter. If you put a sine wave out of your mixer, let's just say you had an analog or digital mixer, but it had analog outputs, and you put a 1K sine wave played out of your mixer, and you put it so the display, the meter read 0, if your mixer has the ability of having a plus 4 output, or if your mixer has a plus 4 output, if you was to measure the voltage on the output of that mixer with a multimeter, or even send it to another analog audio piece of gear, it would actually be a level 4 dB above that reference level of 0.707 volts into a 600-ohm load. That's exactly what zero reference is. So to be technical, to be untechnical, rather, plus 4 is a louder level than minus 10. And essentially, it's 14 dB louder than minus 10, so it's better. And isn't actually not better for any other silly reason.
So plus 4 is 4 dB hotter than zero.
Right, but it's actually, most importantly, it's a reference, it's a ratio.
Right,
so
right.
Your zero, it's possible to calibrate. Like he said, he's got a 28 dB headroom on his console.
Right.
So if his zero is zero at 0.707 volts and he's got 28 dB above that, that means to say he's most probably putting out like 20, you know, whatever voltage he's putting out of his mixer, that ratio can move. So, for example, that zero doesn't have to be, plus 4 doesn't have to be above zero. It's 14 dB away. It's louder than the minus 10 reference level. So if that confuses anybody, I'll just explain one more time. Plus 4 is 14 dB louder, but that's the wrong term, but it has 14 dB hotter volume, let's just call it, or more voltage than minus 10. And the good thing about it, you may ask, in the real world is that because it's louder, it is further away from the noise floor, so you have a better, higher signal-to-noise ratio. And also, because if you've got noise at X and you've got the sound at minus 10, it's closer to X. If you have it at plus 4, it's 14 dB away from X. So you've got a 14 dB more signal-to-noise ratio. So that's why pros like to use it. Also, it's better for driving long-distance lines like mic cables or not mic cables, PAs or something like that. If you're doing a live concert, you've got 300-foot cable, you can drive plus 4 quite nicely.
Can I expand on that just a little bit? Because
sure.
My studio used to be minus 10 for a long time, and I used to get made fun of. And
plenty. You got made fun of because of the RCA cables.
Well, a lot of times that's
you
what
know,
a,
we
minus
can
10
the
is.
Minus
is
the word 10.
Hosen mean anything to you?
Right.
But the amount of RCA cables.
There did used to be a lot of RCA cables.
Hosa.
But the basic, I mean, the for real-world practical application, without being technical about it, basically, professional gear is usually plus 4, and consumer gear is generally minus 10.
That's
like,
very true.
You know, if you have a home receiver and it has line inputs on the back, they're generally minus 10 inputs. And minus 10 is usually on an RCA connector, and plus 4 is usually on an XLR connector, just sort of by tradition. And there are, I know for a fact, there are some very, very expensive gold-plated RCA connectors, because I actually have some in my current studio that just do fine at minus 10. They're also good for SPDIF for digital, but that's a different topic. But generally, you can have a perfectly functional studio with either level as your reference. The thing that makes things complicated is when you have some gear that's plus 4 and some that's minus 10.
Right.
Because if you feed a loud plus 4 output into something that takes a minus 10 input, it's going to distort.
Right.
And there are all kinds of ways to bump things up from minus 10 to plus 4 and back down. We call them bump boxes, but what's their real name? Buffer amplifiers?
Well, I call them beatbox, the real world, but...
Right, that's the studio term, but I think they're called buffer amplifiers. I mean, for a long time, Aphex made these little gray boxes that everybody...
The 104s are called Aphex 104s.
They were...
Minus
like,
10 to plus 4 converters, what it
right.
was.
Right, and if you have gear that has different reference levels in your studio, it's good to not just plug one into the other. I mean, you can always make an adapter cable from XLR to RCA.
Right.
But the truth is, you're probably going to have a level mismatch then, and you want to really do it the right way.
And one thing I want to expand on your expansion, of Bobby's expansion.
Please re-expand.
is, you know, if you have a piece of gear and they have settings for plus 4 and minus 10, it's counterintuitive. You may think that the plus 4, it's going to sound lower, but it's actually buffering because it's expecting a hotter input, and then the minus 10 is going to be louder. So in you know, real world applications,
for input, that's true.
Exactly, for input, it's going to, you know, it may freak you out when you say, hey, plus 4, and you plug something in and it's minus 10, it's actually lower and stuff. So
it is true that if you can also, traditionally, plus 4 is a balanced signal, a minus 10 is an unbalanced signal, and a balanced signal is much better for long runs over long lines.
Can you elaborate on balance versus unbalanced signals?
The way I would probably describe that best would be to ask Bobby to describe it.
I'll answer your question. Let me just quickly say... On a balanced life. Talking about minus 10 and plus 4, just to clarify what you said, which is absolutely correct, but a plus 4 input an input or an output, a plus four connector, let's just say, is normally expects to see the same signal coming to it. So it expects to see a plus four signal coming to it. If you plug a minus 10 signal into a plus four receptor, it's expecting to see plus four. If you send it minus 10, it's going to be 14 dB softer than you expect it to be, and therefore it will sound softer, and it could sound a little good or bad depending on what you choose. So don't let that confuse you. It may be just softer and it's confusing you. But I will add one thing on a creative level. Minus 10 and plus four. A lot of people say, well, the pros use plus four. Very true. There is, for obvious reasons, they do use plus four. But their minus 10 inputs and outputs of some consoles, they sound much better than plus four because, and this is going to your point, that's why I'm talking, you're telling me all about this. Lots of times, minus 10 outputs and inputs are non-balanced, which means to say, I'll explain in a minute, but essentially they only use two conductors to transmit the signal. Balanced signals normally use three conductors. Not normally, they use three conductors to transmit the signal, and they have to go through a certain additional chunk of electronics to make it be a balanced signal, either a transformer or electronically differentiated amplifiers. When it goes through that, it generally, it can degrade the sound because you're actually going through more electronics and it becomes more of a, let's just say, more of an artifact. So lots of times the minus 10 inputs and outputs actually sound cleaner and better than plus four. So just to confuse you all, if you're a pro, listen to the minus 10s, because lots of times you go, man, they sound a lot better.
You know what? Before you move on, Rob, I'm really sorry, man.
Making
fun of your minus 10 studio, okay?
Yeah, hey, you know how many hits? You know how many hits we had out of that minus 10 studio?
I just want to apologize for everybody who.
No, you know what? I used to get laughed
studio.
At all the time.
Belated remorse.
Hundreds.
Better than nothing.
We did hundreds and hundreds. Never. We did hundreds and hundreds of commercials at minus 10. A bunch of hit records at minus 10. No one cares. No one knows when it's done. If I can just simplify the science. One
sure.
second for the plus four, minus 10 difference to a layperson. It basically, let's say you just have a sine wave and you have it either at a loudness to the layman
right.
of plus four or minus 10. Whether your gear is plus four or minus 10, it's basically which level is going to make your meter say zero. In other words, if you have a plus four piece of gear and you put in a plus four signal, it's going to say zero. But if you have a plus four piece of gear and you put in minus 10, it's going to say minus 14 because 4 minus 4 down to 0 and then 0 down to minus 10 mm-hmm. is 14 dB. So really that reference level is just what level do you have to put into this piece of gear to get the meter to say 0.
Zero.
That's
great.
All it really comes down to.
And to, unfortunately to elaborate on that, the 0 of a meter is analog or digital, but we're talking about an analog, like a VU meter. Exactly, exactly.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to elaborate or expand on anything right now.
Can I expand on that though?
Actually, what we're going to do, we're going to take a break right now. And
I want to learn about balance.
And then when we come back, we will get balanced by Bobby.
Balance.
Stand on one foot.
By Bobby.
Balanced
that's what
by Bobby.
Say.
All right, so we'll see you guys on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast, and we're about to get balanced by Bobby. That's going to be a new segment.
Yeah,
balanced
really.
By Bobby. Before the break, we were talking about balanced and unbalanced, and Bobby, tell us about balanced and unbalanced.
Well, Forrest asked, what's the difference between balanced and unbalanced? And the answer is I haven't a clue. Anyway, no, so basically, and I'll tell you a real simple down-to-earth way of looking at it. An unbalanced signal path for analog audio is generally two conductors, which is, let's just say, two conductors. One's a shield, and one's a conductor that runs inside that shield, if it's a typical shielding thing. And that's two conductors. A balanced system has three conductors, and how they do this and why they do this is because what they found was when you send audio down a wire, the wire has the ability to get to pick up RF or electromagnetism from all around. And what would happen is if you've got one conductor that's carrying the signal in an unbalanced system, when that noise gets if that cable gets in a noisy environment like electromagnetism next to a transformer by a dimmer, that sort of junk, the noise will actually get induced into the wire and then get passed down that wire. And at the end, if it's an amplifier or whatever the hell, if it's a recording device, you actually hear a hum or a buzz or bzzz, that sort of stuff.
So that's unbalanced.
So unbalanced is more prone to noise. What they decided was, well, let's see how we can get rid of this. What about if we ran two wires in that same shield? So you have now three conductors, which is a balanced system. You have two wires in that shield, and they twist them. So they twist them equally every an equal interval. So they're very each half an inch, basically, and they twist them. And the theory behind that is, if those two wires are twisted around each other, if the sound hit, if this noise hits, interjects or intercuts rather, mm-hmm. intercepts rather, the word I'm looking for, these two wires equally, then you'll have equal noise on both those wires. And they said, well, that's great. What are we going to do with it when we get to the other end? They said, well, why don't we put it into a transformer and make it go back to itself? And it's called summon difference. And essentially what it does is it phases out or phase cancels out everything common on that line that's got put into it, basically, so it rejects the noise. So what you actually happen is you've got a transformer or electronic differential amplifier at the other end, which has a look at the one wire and looks at the other one and adds them together, and what the resultant is, and reverses it and adds it together, and what the resultant is that sound without the noise, and that's what balancing is. Balancing is.
Mm.
If that helped anyway at all, I doubt. But
well, is the sound like the noise cancels itself out?
Well, because you have two copies of the noise that are out of phase with each other, and then they get summed up, so they add up to zero.
Done by the transformer, of course.
Done by either transformer or electronic differential amplifiers, electronically balanced differential amplifiers, yeah. And a transformer is an ideal way of doing it. It was an ideal way of doing it, except because they're expensive, one, and they're a bit of a load, two, and also they did degrade the sound because they had slow slew rates and all sorts of artifacts that come with transformers, which are nice. I personally like for some things, but not everybody liked them. So they said, well, you know, these transformers are slowing the sound down. You know, then back in the 80s, they started ripping them all out of all the transformers out of tape machines. It was an operation that you had to do for the tape machines and rip the transformers out and put in diff amps, differential amplifiers to get the same balancing system. And the nice thing about a diff amp is that you can adjust it. So you have a positive gain and a negative gain. And if you get a little bit of noise, you can tweak it with a scope, oscilloscope, and actually get it completely clean. Because sometimes there is a wire length difference between the two conductors, very small, but enough to have a difference, and you can tweak it to the wire, and that's what the tweak heads did.
Now explain ground lift then.
Ground lift is...
Because that's something that a lot of people run into.
Yes, it's a great question, Exactly a good question when it comes to essentially balanced and unbalanced. That's a very good point. I didn't talk to that, but an unbalanced system generally has two conductors, and both of them are one carries the signal and one is the screen, and also one sometimes is used as the shield and the ground between the two pieces of gear. And the problem with that is, of course, that any noise gets induced into that shield also goes down to that common shielding of that piece of equipment that you're sending to. So when you use a balanced system, you have the signals, the two wires carrying the signal purely, and the shield would be around those two wires in the balance system purely for shielding, purely to catch the extraneous RF and EMF and all that junk and take it down to ground, not to pass a grounding signal between the two pieces of gear. So what they would normally do in most cases, if it's a correctly grounded place, is lift the shield or the ground on the balanced end of the send side so you wouldn't get a ground loop. If you did have them connected, you would have two conductors sending the signal and the shield, which would cause a ground loop. So you'd have a ground wire trying to undo itself, and it's sort of like a feedback loop. Exactly
right.
What it is.
60 cycle.
Actually, it comes 120 because it goes back 60 and back again. So it's a double.
Interesting.
120, yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, double. You know, we ran at 50 in UK, in England. We're 50 hertz or 100 hertz, but we're 50 hertz or 120, 60 here. And that's...
You know, that's great information.
Nerdy stuff, though. It's very hard to...
No, but it's great information, I was going to say, because even though it's a little deep, sometimes, you know, what this means is you know, if you want to get that great sound, if you want to get that sound, you know, so it sounds real, quote unquote, mm-hmm. real sound.
Yes.
You know, start looking at your cables. Just start looking at the simple things. Looking at the signals. Make sure you've got the proper signal and the proper cables and balanced and unbalanced, and even the proper reference levels too, and the proper levels.
So true, because the first way to turn off somebody, a producer or somebody that has a set of ears, is for you to throw up your master, and there's a hum.
Yeah.
And if you have a hum in your room, not good.
It also brings up it sort of brings validity to the different pricing of certain cables, because for a long time I never understood why 1/4-inch cable was so significantly more than another.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
You know, good cables make a difference, and just having the proper levels and the proper wiring. Go ahead.
I'm going to expand on what Bobby said. Now, there's one other aspect to this that I realized I ran into when I was wiring my place, and that is normally if you're running lines between gear, if it's minus 10, it's on RCAs, and if it's balanced plus 4, then it's on XLR, you know, mic connectors. But there's a lot of gear like synthesizers that have 1/4 inches on the back, and 1/4 inch can be balanced or unbalanced. 1/4 inch, if it's unbalanced, it has 2 connectors, and if it's balanced, it has tippering and sleeve. It has 3 connectors. And on the back of most synths, if you look, you'll see a lot of times it's labeled whether it's balanced or not, and a lot of modern synths are balanced. You have to be really kind of aware of this when you're hooking stuff up, because like if you have a keyboard that has a balanced output, it has tippering and sleeve, and then you're plugging into a synth input on a device like the Pro Tools 96i synth interface is all 1/4 inch and it's tippering sleeve. If you actually use a 3-conductor 1/4 inch cable, it's going to sound better because it's going to be a true plus 4 balanced signal than if you use a 2-conductor cable. So you really do actually have to be aware of that. Not all 1/4 inches are the same in a studio.
That's a good point.
Usually it's labeled.
For people that – just a quick cheat sheet. If anybody wants to make up cables from balanced to unbalanced, or plus 4, minus 10 is the common thing. Generally, you've got 3 conductors going to 2 conductors. They normally take pin the tip of an XLR – the tip of a 1/4 inch would be hot, positive, let's just say, and that would go to pin 2 of your XLR.
Right.
The ring, which is the second one down, which is the negative, that would go to pin 3 of your XLR.
Correct.
And the shield would go to pin 1, or if it's a floating ground or star-fed ground system, it would be floated. But either way, it would go to pin 1 of your XLR. But if you're coming from an unbalanced signal, going to a balanced signal, you take tip, which would go to pin 1, and you take sleeve and ring would be put together and goes to pins 1 and 3. So you'd have an unbalanced to balanced cable. And that's the simplest, cheapest, friendliest way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
And this is where you rewind the podcast and listen over if you didn't get all that.
All right, we're going to move on.
True.
The next question that Lee asked, and this is going to be the All Lee Show.
Okay.
Yay,
and
Lee.
He actually asked, this one's for Bobby, but I know that Bill would be a better man to answer this one. He wanted to know how he could sidechain on a DAW. He uses Logic specifically, although he will be getting Pro Tools soon. Bill, on the Logic sidechaining, is it relatively straight ahead? Where you assign it to an aux and a bus, and you just set that input on your
Not even – like what's interesting about Logic is there's sidechain elements everywhere. There's a bunch – or there's sidechain in the ES2. There's sidechain in the Ultrabeat. The compressor has sidechaining. The gate has sidechaining. And sidechaining, is he referring to like a master bus sidechain or a gated effect?
Well, the next part of his question, he was talking about parallel compression to his kick drums, but I'm just – that part was just specifically
parallel compression and sidechain are different.
I know they're different, so I think he just was talking sidechaining in general. Because I don't think – you know what? I'm amazed at the amount of people that don't know how to sidechain on any platform or have used it. And actually, I'm not really amazed, because that's kind of an old school way of thinking. And a lot of the guys that are growing up with the DAWs, you know, you don't go for that sidechain effect much.
Okay, so here's the easy way. In, say, if he's talking about sidechaining his kick drum, I'll bet you $10 he's in dance music. because, I mean, that's just a guess. Maybe you guys disagreed. You guys looking at me funny.
I'm waiting for you to, okay, to so, elaborate.
No, I'm just buying time, you know? So, here's Bill thinking about logic in the background, right? So all you have to do is put the logic compressor, which I still think is one of the very best sounding little
great compressor
compressors there is. I mean, it's
lovely.
That thing is killer. Put it on your master fader, and there's a sidechain input. So what I do is I don't take the kick drum that I'm listening to. Say if you have a kick drum through a traditional song, and you want that the entire mix to thrust and pump based on that kick drum. If you come to a break, what's going to happen if you have it sidechained to the kick drum itself is that the material in the break is not going to thrust. It's going to the signal will run out. So the way around this is to create, say, another track and put exact copy of the kick drum, but run it all the way through the song, and then take the fader or just no output on it at all, okay? And then go to the master bus compressor on the master fader, click the sidechain button, and assign it to that track. This is a ghost sidechain that you're never going to hear that track.
It's commonly called a key track sometimes.
Yeah, it's a key input for like a stay level compressor, all that stuff. And so you'd never hear this track. It's a ghost track, but it is affecting the ratio of, and it's what causes it to surge, you know, like that, where it dips for the kick and it raises for the, and it's a great, great effect.
Great. And I just want to tell people that aren't familiar with sidechaining, all sidechaining is, in a real simple way, is using a signal to control another signal, another effect, another, you know, yeah. Whether it's
right. I mean, typically with a compressor, if you're using a compressor normally, the input signal to the compressor is what determines how much it compresses.
Right.
But if you're using it in sidechain mode, instead of using its input to know how much it compresses, it uses a separate signal to tell it that.
Totally correct. And one quick thing about a gating effect with sidechain, get a long keyboard pad on one track, put a gate on it, a logic gate, and then take any drum loop on a second track with no output, and then on the gate of the keyboard track, select the track, a drum loop. And then what you're going to hear is you're going to hear that keyboard pad do exactly the pattern of the drum loop that you're not hearing.
Right.
It's insane.
And
it's
actually,
very cool.
That's pretty common use in you know, dance music and electronic music. And actually a famous example of that would be the keyboard intro for Crazy.
For Crazy. Yeah. Yeah, that's probably the best known example ever. Yeah. Yeah,
and this, the options in sidechain and gating, is particularly within Logic, but also Pro Tools, are cool stuff happens.
It was a crazy thing we used to do back in the day, scary days. There's a thing called Keypex. I don't know if anybody remembers any of them.
That's what I wanted to say.
The old Keypex.
Yeah.
And we used to hire the drummer to come and play a cowbell figure, and like bass da 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 bass da 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 or whatever, and we'd have guitar playing like 1/5 chords. 1/4, 1/5 notes, power chords, and it would just key, and it'd be a great sound.
Yeah,
you know what? I'll give away one of my secrets that I use all the time for that kind of stuff.
Okay, hold on, I want to write this down.
It's not very complicated, but like to do that kind of seal effect, because as old as that record is, people still want that sound a lot of times.
Yeah, because it's cool.
It's a great sound. So what I'll do is I'll set up a keyboard split. Sometimes I'll do it with two keyboards, sometimes with a keyboard split, but I'll just have it where with the left hand I'm playing the chords. Like a pad sound, and then the right hand is the gate trigger.
Yep.
And I just usually use the MIDI gate that's built into Cubase because it's very simple. It gets a note on, it opens the gate, it gets a note off, it closes the gate. And I'll play it all from one keyboard, and I'll usually play the rhythm with my right hand just because I'm right-handed, so it feels a little better. But I'll play these long, drawn-out pads with my left hand, trigger the gate with the right hand, record the whole thing onto one MIDI track, and that way the performance can be edited. So if you edit some of the right-hand information, you're editing the rhythm that it plays, and if you edit the left-hand information, you're editing what chord you're hearing whenever the gate's open.
Genius!
damn.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Because it's a live performance thing, then. It's not a post-production effect. Yeah. You can actually sit and play it live.
Right.
No, that makes sense.
And you can use the ADSL on the gate to design the envelope or use the duct feature. So
I can do that seal thing for you all day.
Well, the good thing about that is it's the recallability, you know?
Oh, yeah. It comes back like any other track.
Contelli's a new kid on the block. Recallability. When you're thinking about performance, he's thinking about how I can save it so I can do it again.
Hey, man, when you get a hop in and out of projects as often as I do.
Believe me, the reason I figured out this way to do it is because I needed it to be instantly recallable because
Well, that's the same thing as key switching. Symphonic composers in Logic will have a French horn sound on samples, and then when they want it to dig deeper, they have a second MIDI keyboard that switches the sample. That's key switching.
Yep.
Do that too.
That's awesome.
New Inna does it quite nicely now on their own little track.
Yeah, they have that
key switching track.
I forget what it's called though. It has a name. The expression editor expression track, I think.
It's called Ed. Let's keep moving forward.
What? No, I say we get stuck right here. Do we have more questions?
We do, actually.
You know, we're going to send him some questions.
I know. Actually, we're going to be wrapping it up. This one's actually kind of interesting. I've been doing what I think is parallel compression to my kick drums, having to send to an aux channel, then compressing the hell out of it and mixing it back with the original signal. That's what it is, right? Is that parallel compression?
If I understand what he's saying, yes. And when he says, read that to me again, he sends, or aux sends?
Having to send to an aux channel, then compressing the hell out of it and mixing it back with the original signal.
Is he talking about in Pro Tools or he doesn't say? Because that is
– He doesn't say. It's
that is the way you do it in Pro Tools.
No, that's parallel compression, with the exception that typically you run the whole kit through to this – to the bus compression in a New York style compression.
Right.
You're not just running one element.
Well, let's just start with for people out there, what is parallel compression?
Real quickly, parallel compression, essentially what it is, first of all, really quickly, parallel compression, when you put something through a compressor, it controls the dynamics of the sound of it, which is good and bad because sometimes it squashes the hell out of it and squashes all the life out of it. So about 35, 40 years ago, engineers got fed, actually even longer, 40 years ago. So people got fed up with that sound. They said, well, how can we hear this compression as well as keep the natural dynamics of the music.
The attacks, specifically attacks.
The dynamics, because the dynamics and the attacks and the releases too, because it screws that up too. So basically, essentially, look at parallel compression is if you put your sound of your instrument through a compressor, but the compressor itself had a wet and dry knob on it, if you can imagine that. And when you put it in the middle, you're hearing both the compressed signal and the uncompressed signal. That's the way to look at it. That's really what parallel compression is. So knowing how it works, you can basically have how I work it. It's the best way to work, absolutely the best way to work, I personally think, is using discrete buses on your console that are compressors. And you have either auxiliary sends or separate buses that go to those compressors. And you can choose to send whatever you like to those buses. So essentially, if you send your signal of your drums, let's say, you hear it on a normal bus, no compression, yet you want to put some compression to it, but you don't want to put the compressor inserted on the track, you can use an auxiliary send and send those drums off to a compressor that's on a separate set of channels, let's just say, and you can hear the compressed sound as well simultaneously in parallel. That's why it's called parallel compression.
So there's
serial compression.
And you get a little
well.
Thickening of that, like on a kit, you would get a little
tell you
thick without losing the high end and the attack?
It depends the way you set it up. You can set it up. I can show you. I could possibly record you 5 files and show you how to use it. But essentially, it's the attack, the release, the makeup gain, and the threat, and the ratio, and how you're using the compressor. Will determine what characteristic you can make. I've done this before just for fun. I've taken the cheesiest drum box, which was a D4 about 10 years ago that I could find, and make it sound quite loud and naughty sounding by using parallel compression.
Naughty.
Well, speaking of naughty, so in my Logic Auto Load, I do just what you said, discrete
buses.
Buses.
Yep.
And I always have a destroyer bus, and that is, the bit compressor, all the. I just have a bunch of, like, guitar amps,
right.
All kinds of destroyer things, and then I often will have a gate on the end of the destroyer track, that's gated to something else, sidechained to something else in the mix.
So you can,
and then I can wet and dry. Just if I want a little destruction on the vocal during a certain place, I just roll the send up, and it's there. And that's another.
There's one essential thing for all parallel peeps out there. The most important thing about parallel processing. Now we're talking about parallel compression, but do you know there's parallel de-essing? I use about 12 different types of paralleling, and there's tons of beautiful ways of using parallel EQ. We're taking a mono signal and making it sound extremely sexy is like next chapter. So we can get into that some other time. But either way,
dead sexy.
Hey, there's parallel parking.
There's parallel. I'm good at that too. They say you got. The most important thing about parallel processing of all types is and I'm talking to digital people first of all, let's just say, if you're using a digital parallel processing system, make sure you test this first of all. Send your signal through your parallel chain at equal gain, so it's exactly the same volume, and flip the phase of that compressor when the compressor is bypassed, and make sure that in fact your latency compensation in your DAW is accurate and working. Because if you have parallel compressor and the compressor is either badly written code or the DAW itself does not have
delay compensation,
what you're going to get is a horrible sound that may or may not work for you, but more chances than not you're not going to get or hear the correct effect. And what you're going to
be
having,
you won't know that you're not hearing it. It's just going to be
You're going to get comb filtering is what's going to happen. Huh. And it's going to get actually the reverse effect. Instead of having a focused, punchy drum kit, let's just say, you're going to have a washy kind of digital sounding.
It moves farther away from your face.
So it starts to sound like a spectrasonic sort of thing.
So you flip the phase so that it actually goes away. So it's 100%.
100% disappears.
Okay.
Yeah, there's not phase reverse on a lot of plugins.
But I'm saying that's why you use a bus as an insert return for your effects. That's one of the other reasons I didn't bother elaborating on that. But that's the best way to do it, because then you can actually put your compressor in the path, get the volume going, say, oh, that's nice. Let me just switch the compressor off, put it in bypass so the channel is still working so you'd hear both sounds simultaneously. Press the phase button. Does the sound disappear completely? If it doesn't, then the volumes are not identically matched. That means, and then you accordingly adjust that to accordingly.
Sure.
Make the thing completely disappear. Then stick in the compressor and see if, in fact, the sound still disappears. With the digital compressors, it should be phase accurate. C1 on waves. There's a bunch of them that do a really beautiful job of doing
that's
it.
Right.
Let me expand on that a little bit.
Because there are a few shows.
We've been spending a ton of time recently testing a lot of different ways with Bobby's help of doing parallel compression, mostly in Pro Tools, but we've done it in Nuendo and Cubase and other things as well. But there are a few things that people need to keep in mind. Like if you insert a trim plugin, say in Pro Tools, to flip the phase, because that's the sort of the least DSP hog of a plugin they have. If you insert a trim plugin to flip the phase, the trim plugin introduces a few samples of delay on its own. So really the way to do a test, if you're playing with this phase flipping stuff, is to put the trim plugin on every channel that you might want to flip the phase on. That way everybody has that same trim plugin
delay
at the beginning. They're all delayed.
Yeah.
That's real important, and it's something that it's easy to miss.
That's very good. That's a very good point. But very scary that Pro Tools, we won't go there, but it's a scary thought that you have to do there. But
well, I will say this, though. After a bunch of testing, we've confirmed that, I mean, the systems I'm testing on are Pro Tools HD rigs, but no matter how complicated a session we built, and we've built some really, really complicated ones using over 100 buses and really crazy stuff, including a lot of surround stuff, the Pro Tools latency compensation is dead on accurate. No matter how complicated it was, as long as we're using plugins that have less latency than what the delay compensation engine set for, it's been perfect. The phase flips and it's completely zero afterwards. So it took me a while to have faith in that because I wanted to hear it with my own ears, but Pro Tools is definitely trustworthy with that, as is Nuendo and Cubase, which we've known for a long time.
Now, Ableton, I'm not so sure because I've been using some heavy, heavy Waves plugins, the Jack Joseph Hooligan, all the just heavier DSP plugins in Ableton.
You have to be careful because some of them are beyond the latency. Well, like on Waves, if you use the L316, which is an RTAS plugin, it's incredibly long latency. More than the delay compensation engine can handle in Pro Tools. So you just have to know what your DAW can actually handle. Another thing I want to mention in Pro Tools that a lot of people don't know is you don't have to use an aux send for this kind of thing. If you have an audio track in Pro Tools, you can assign it to multiple outputs and buses simultaneously by holding the control key when you assign it. So you can have one track and assign it to bus 1 and 2 and then 5 and 6 and then 9 and 10 then an output 31 and 32 all at the same time. And that's actually when you're doing parallel compression for mastering, which is what I've been doing a lot of lately, that's how I do it instead of using a bunch of aux sends set to pre and stuff. Because right. if you have your track set to 0 and you have it bust to multiple outputs, it's just cleaner because you know everything's going to be at the same level. The other thing that people don't realize a lot of times is taking a mono sound and putting it in the middle of – like panning it in the middle of a stereo output is different than taking that same mono sound and assigning it to the left output and the right output fully.
3dB.
You have to, right, 3dB. You have to make sure you know if you're dealing in stereo, make sure it's all stereo.
Right.
If you're dealing in mono, make sure it's all mono. But if you have a source signal that's stereo and then you do some process to it that turns it into mono or vice versa, your levels are going to get.
Which is in Logic is where in the preferences you want your pan law to be 3dB compensated. If you don't have that checked, you get not as good a sounding mixes.
Right. And when you start panning, you start to get volume shift.
Right, right.
It's not equal.
Now, if you wanted to do multiple outputs for a channel in Logic, I'm sorry, but you'd have to go down to the environment.
The environment window, in which case you take out a soldering iron and just ram it through your temple.
which case you pick up the phone and say, hello, Steinberg.
You're divorced, you're back at your mom's place, and that's the place to discover
the environment window. is
Really? You have to go to the environment to do multiple outputs?
No, to get divorced.
All right. Well, hey, listen, we're going to be wrapping it up. And,
what? Lee must have more questions.
He does, but, you know, this next question is a whole show into itself.
What is it? So we can –
Let's rattle it out. Come on, let's do it quickly.
Come on.
No, this is not
going
to be – this is not going to be quick, but I will tell you what it is because we may have to, you know, answer this one on this
one. In one sentence or less, each guy. Here we go.
No. Okay, let's give it a shot then. Hold on. I'll tell you right now.
Hey, we're here for you, Lee. We're trying.
We're just throwing down. Okay, represent. I represent for the middle guy. These guys are high end.
Yeah, these guys. Don't look at this one.
Okay,
these
here we
guys,
go.
Look at my.
Ready? I don't suppose you guys could explain the controls on reverbs. You've done compressors and EQs before, but I'm from the digital school where it's choose a room and how much in the mix. I've seen some reverbs with things like pre-delay and those sort of things, so I guess that's a Bobby question.
All right.
Well, he says he doesn't suppose we can do it, and I agree with him. So.
There's two words. No, I know. Here we go. And dry. That's it.
Okay.
But reverbs are – I mean, that's like a
– No, it's not easy. Reverse.
We could do a whole show on reverbs because I love reverb.
That'd be a boring show.
All right. So basically, he wants to know what the RC60 time is, but reverb time, was it?
No, he's just saying
pre-delay.
There's pre-delay. He just wants to know about reverbs.
Okay. Reverbs, specifically digital reverbs, needless to say, they are trying to emulate an acoustic environment.
It's not even specifically digital, just reverb in general.
He wants pre-delay specifically.
Okay, pre-delay is specifically. Is that what he wants to know?
No. Just tell me about reverbs.
Okay, reverbs. Well, reverb is a digital device generally that creates an acoustic space, synthetically creates an acoustic space. That's what digital reverb is.
Right.
Analog or plate reverb and other types of reverbs. There are other different kinds of mechanical reverbs which actually have springs with speakers playing in them, and you have a microphone at the other end, and it thinks it's in a wet environment. That's a plate reverb. You have a chamber, which is a little concrete room in most cases with crooked walls, a speaker or two in there, and two microphones. You feed sound through them from your console, and the microphones record it, and it's called a chamber. So when you see your digital reverb unit, you go through your patches looking for sounds, and it says hall. Generally, they're trying to model the sound of a performance hall or a live hall or a rock and roll
auditorium
hall,
or something
like that. If you see the word chamber, which is normally a category, it's normally a small room, which is, you know, sometimes 25 feet by 20 feet, which is generally a man-made concrete room with a couple of speakers in it, a couple of microphones, and it's called a chamber. And sometimes you see things called plates, which are essentially an electronic device which kind of looks like a 10-foot by 4-foot box standing on its side, and it essentially has a piece of metal in it, like a big chunk of sheet metal. A sheet metal plate, sometimes it's gold, but normally is, which is very thin, and it has an electromagnetic transducer on it, so that when you send signal to it, the plate actually shakes, the metal plate shakes, and the microphone in that box actually records the sound of that shaking, so it sounds like a sort of like a metal shaky plate. Very great for vocals, very good for dance claps and that sort of thing, very popular for finger pops and that sort of stuff, very much.
Beautiful.
Beautiful sound. And then there's an EMT 240s, 140s, that was the stuff.
Okay, and now really and quick, what kind of controls are on reverbs?
Well,
there's
generally...
There's a spring reverb, mustn't forget that, carry on.
Oh, we love the spring reverb. It's the only one you can actually hit on the side and it sounds as cool as if you put
a
song to it.
It's the most storm on Star Trek.
You know you're legit then.
Exactly. The most common controls on a reverb would be the pre-delays. There's two halves to what the reverb does, basically, the pre-delays and the tails. The pre-delay is more like the fast slapback that any wall that you're close to would give you. You know, if you're sitting 6 feet from a wall and you clap, the different walls and ceilings in the room and different surfaces, maybe the desk that you're sitting at, those all create a slap that is generally what the pre-delay controls would control. And then the tail is the ring out, the what you would think of as the long ring of the hall.
Decay.
The decay, yeah, which is a longer sound. And different reverb manufacturers have argued which is more important, and the truth is they're both important. You have to have a really good, complex pre-delay system, and you have to have a really good, complex tail algorithm for it to sound good. And I've designed a lot of factory presets for a lot of the most popular reverbs, and probably the one that people use the most is the TCM 6000. I still see my presets in use in a lot
of
places when I go there.
Tell me one of your presets so I know.
I did a lot of the... like the authentic rooms, like 10 by 10 room, 20 by 20 room, 40 by 40 room. Oh, 40 by 40, that was magic. That was great. And then I also do a lot of the weird effecty ones like oil drum and those kinds of things. But I did a lot of the realistic spaces. But honestly, the way I designed reverbs, because I designed the reverbs for the PCM 80 and 90 for Lexicon. And Scott Gershon and Andrew Sheps did too. We were all working on these things for a long time. But, but generally, I got to the point where I knew what every control did, and I learned that just by playing around with it. You know, if you're playing with the pre-delay controls, you're controlling the slappy kind of stuff, and the tails and the density and that kind of thing was for the ring out. But what I would end up doing is just tweak the knobs until I heard a sound that I liked and try to get a sound in my head and then try to do it with the knobs.
And so it should be.
Yeah, but the last thing I would – but then I would just come up with the name of what it sounded like. So I wouldn't set out – yeah, I didn't set out to do
– turn a knob until you hear something. That's the way it's done.
And what I would also do is I would – like in the M6000, there are a lot of things like dance snares and bright snares and vocal plates and all these things. And I didn't do all those. I did some. But – I would always come up with a reverb that I thought was cool and then try a bunch of source signals through it to see what actually worked best with it. But anybody who tells you they can sit down and say, I am now going to design a 30 by 30 foot room that has a tile ceiling and, you know, carpet in one corner of the floor, you know, maybe they can do it. I've never seen anybody who can really do that. But you become familiar with the controls and you'll learn if you're programming a reverb for yourself. If you turn up the density of the pre-delays and you shorten that time, it's going to seem like a smaller space because you're moving the walls in towards you. And if you reduce the density of the decay, that's going to affect the sound in a way that you can predict. Were you going to add something there?
Yeah, you know, I was just going to say that the actual terminology that you see is diffusion often is the case.
Yeah.
And the only way I can really say where they got these names from, is the best way is to explain it, is to, if you compare it to when you're in a room in an acoustic space and you know what they're saying when they say diffusion. If you're in a hall... Okay, so anyway, digital reverb. Sorry, you carry on. But basically, digital reverb, one
I'm
thing, just to elaborate on what Rob said.
expand.
The pre-delay, just to there's a thing called pre-delay and this thing called pre-echoes, not to get confused. Pre-delay is the duration of no sound before the reverb occurs from the sound source. So if, for example, you have finger pops, you go click, and you've got a 45 millisecond reverb, you go... because there's a little bit of air gap. They do that because, one, it makes a mix sound better because you have the reverb behind the instrument so you hear it, and two, it paints the illusion that you're further and you're closer, the sound source is closer to you and they're in front of the hall. If you have no pre-delay and the instrument starts to settle into the reverb and it starts to be more behind the mix, so that's one.
And that one thing, the pre-delay, can really make the difference between it sounding like a big, expensive, wonderful reverb and a cheapy... That's crappy reverb.
So true.
It's a much bigger space if you delay.
Absolutely. And then there's the thing called the pre-echo, and pre-echo is normally the first reflections that come off of the wall. So talking about an acoustic space, if you're in a rock and roll hall and the guy's on stage and he hits the snare drum and you're sitting in the middle of the auditorium, you would hear, because you're a long way away from the snare drum,
right.
And you would hear the snare drum and then free air space and then the reverb. Now, if that whole stage, let's just say, was a concrete stage and had a lot of wood around him or something like that, when he hits the snare, what you would actually hear is bang of the snare, then a couple of milliseconds afterwards you'd hear clack, 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 clack of that same snare bouncing off of different walls and objects at different frequencies, different EQs, so you'd hear crack.
Which drives drummers crazy.
And you know what? I misspoke earlier. I referred to that as
pre-delay.
It's early reflections.
Yes, exactly. Early reflections.
And different manufacturers like TC Electronics take huge pride.
Yes.
Well, but they take huge pride in their early reflections. And if you look at how dense their early reflections are, that's why their reverb sound as good as they do.
I got you. The other thing I was going to tell you about on pre-delay is it also on vocals, a lot of vocals that you think are dry, if you listen, they're not
That's
dry.
Right.
They just have their pre-delay tweaked, and you can hear that little reverb in the background, and it sounds great.
Yeah. Sounds great.
It's a great way to get your vocal, you know.
So
have
I think it makes it sound good, and like fatter or something.
It does.
One also newbie mistake, in my opinion, with reverb and vocals is it's always – these guys will probably throw in on this, but to my ears, it's always best to take the EQ of the reverb and take off some of the highs so that you don't have that the S's triggering the verb, because then all you're going to hear is this distracting.
And a lot of reverbs these days have that
built in.
Yeah. And that's definitely something you want to tweak.
But if you're listening to your vocal track and you hear this annoying high-end pang every time the singer has an S, if I mean, it's subjective, obviously.
Well, here's one thing.
On a lot of new stuff.
Very true. Here's one thing. Talking about exactly what you're talking about, and then talking about parallel processing. This is one of the many processes that are commonly used for mixers use when they have a lead vocalist that's either a female has a lot of sibilance or they're singing S's or they want to compress the voice to make it sound cool and everything. Sometimes the S's get excited far too much in the reverb, but they want a bright reverb. Sometimes they'll put a keyed EQ on the back of the reverb so it's bright when the person's singing. When they stop singing, it has a slow release and the treble.
Genius!
Basically a de-esser.
It's actually a filter. It's like a Sherman filter kind of effect on the back of a gate. It's really nice on drums because you get that modern Phil Collins sort of sound. You know, like a
you know that old sound.
It goes doosh. It's like a very dark sound.
I'm going to put reverb on every single one of our tracks when I mix this.
I think you should.
And just pre-delay it.
Well, this to my ears, like the skillful use of reverb and then especially delay, is like that's the final frontier. That's the Men from the Boys right in there.
Right, and speaking of Men from the Boys, we're stopping there.
He wants to go out and say,
"Masculine." But what are we?
Well, we should thank Lee.
We are the yes. Lee, thank you for writing us 2 months ago.
All right. We've had fires here.
Yeah. But we've been a little busy. But, you know, they were great questions, I thought, and deserved.
Good questions, Lee. Yes, mate. Where's Lee from?
And he's from Australia.
You're from Oz.
Yep, he's from Australia. And,
he's a Joey.
I'm going to come down there, Lee, in January.
Yeah, and he, you know.
Where's he from?
He's from.
What city?
Let's see what city he says. He did not say what city he's from, but
he's from Perth.
He wants to come out to L.A. And Lee, if you're ever out in Los Angeles, you can
come and hook us up.
Drop me an email and come join us for the podcast.
Come look at fire flames out there. Of course, right. Windows.
All right, guys. We're going to wrap it up. And hey, you know, this is a meat and potato show. Every once in a while, we need to do this.
Meat and potatoes.
It's good for you.
Taters?
I'll tell you what.
Taters. What's taters?
I learned a lot. I learned a lot from you guys. I learned a lot from you, Bobby.
You're too kind. But not at the podcast. You mean that afterwards, don't you?
I learned a lot from Rob and from Bill, from Forrest.
I just
suck it all in.
We learned that you have 3 Gretsch kits.
And then you should give one to me. You should see how I dismantled my V drums in 2 minutes. That wasn't pretty. Anyway,
we're going to wrap it up. And if you have any comments or questions that you want answered within at least 3 months, you can write us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. You can check us out on our Facebook page and our MySpace page. And before we go, Rob, you working on anything?
Working on a lot of things. Actually, one exciting thing that happened today, just a coincidence it was today, is the Waltology album that we remixed and remastered is officially on iTunes now.
Oh, great.
And also officially at Amazon.com and a bunch of other stores. And available at the Noisy Neighbors store, which has been working for now a day and a half, and I just about killed myself this weekend to do that. But you can actually buy the physical CD at the Noisy Neighbors store, which is at noisyneighbors.com/store. But if you go to the Waltology website, that can point you to all these things. But it's exciting. It's already started selling really well.
Great.
Oh, that's awesome, dude.
So we got that going. We've got Fox Fagan's EP is out there and available. The Orbit Monkey album is out there and available. And there's a bunch more coming. Plus, we're also mixing two network TV shows, Crime 360 for A&E, which last Thursday was apparently one of the highest rated ones they've ever had.
Wow.
And so we're a new mixer to that show, but that doesn't hurt.
No, it doesn't hurt.
To have good
at all,
ratings.
Man.
And then we're also doing a show for National Geographic that I'm not at liberty to discuss yet, but it's going really well.
Cool.
And that stuff's all in 5.1 for broadcast, which is something we've never done before.
Wow.
And also.
And we're also in the studio with a band. Actually, the band, when Wendy was out here, remember Wendy Sinclair was out here?
Yeah.
The band that she was out here to visit, which features two of her sons, Johnny One Match. We're in the studio with them on some stuff. And that's enough, isn't it?
Yeah, that's enough.
Okay.
that's some good stuff, man.
Good stuff.
It's a lot of stuff.
Bill?
I'm working with some people in Austin on a project, Pro Tools audio / console deal. I had no idea Austin was as cool as it is.
Oh, yeah. It's cool.
Yeah, it's going down.
I did a...
And everything comes with a bowl of cheese.
Yeah.
Done a queso. Everything. That's why I like visiting.
And the Tarzaki. I'll be going back and forth, I'm pretty sure, on that. I did a record release party for my buddy, played drums, and triggered Ableton Loops in Silver Lake a couple weeks ago. I also did a electronic set that night, which is cool.
Wow.
And I've been playing lots of different gigs on drums. Who knew? People wanted drummers. But all of a sudden, I got all this paying work for drums, and I'm, like, not saying no.
Yeah, pay is good.
Yeah. And then I'm doing my tutorials still, grinding.
Fantastic.
Forrest.
I need to write 270s guitar tracks for... It's a documentary coming out about a stuntman. I don't know a whole lot about it, but apparently it has international. It's going to be an international release, and I'm happy that I'll be credited for music composition.
That's cool.
You know, on the posters as well as the end credits and everything.
That's so great.
Yeah, so I'm really happy about that. And if this goes well, God willing, I may have two other opportunities to actually score.
That's cool.
So I'm really happy about that and, you know, working on my double bass still. amping up the speed to the extreme.
And I'm Bobby. You got nominated for an Emmy, right?
I did indeed.
And
third one missed.
Did you say indeed?
What soap was that for?
One Life.
One Life.
Yeah, that's what I'm working on right now. Doing my last gig with One Life right now. I'm actually on my last one.
Last one?
Yeah, for now. I mean, the season ended, so... Okay. Well, my season's ended, I think. The budget's ended. That's my season. ended. And I'm doing a project. I'm finishing off this little... I keep saying it's a project, but it's a mate of mine and I are doing this little... I'll tell you all about it later on when we can disclose it, but it's going to basically... It's like a web-oriented song competition game, let's put it that way. Where so that's what I've been working on. Oh, and I've been working on Fishy Fridays.
Yeah, now you when I was talking about what I was working on, you looked at me like I was forgetting something.
Fishy Fridays.
Oh, is that what it was?
You're working on Halibut. That's what you should eat.
Yeah, no, it's Rainbow Roll, I believe. This week we graduate up to Rainbow Roll.
That's right, because Rob just got introduced to sushi.
But you know what? The reason it's working.
He's doing good.
But you know what? He is an amazing – Bobby is an amazing sushi teacher, and you need to have a good teacher.
You really do.
And he's good.
I will agree because, like, Larry Droba from API, he introduced me to – to sushi, and it really helps when you've got somebody there
to hold your hand.
That's right, telling you, don't think of this as raw fish.
You're like, no. How can I not? It's raw fish.
No, but
you
no,
gotta have someone who's a good teacher.
You're absolutely right.
And Rob's a good, he's a good student.
I'm a good student. I'll try stuff.
But the first couple of weekends, he his knuckles were white holding onto his rice bowl.
That's teriyaki. You graduated when you no longer order that side of rice.
He doesn't
know
it anymore. He's like, dude.
No, it's all fish.
He's doing it all.
I'm doing it all.
Well, you guys are making me hungry.
We should all do it. We should all go one night.
We should go
to the bash.
We'll do a fish cast.
And I've been to sushi with Larry Dropa, by the way, and his kids once ordered this gigantic boat in Maryland.
Oh yeah.
Have you ever been to
that? Yeah, no, that's a giant
wooden boat with like a million pieces of sushi on it.
Wow.
No. Yeah, it's like cool.
I've been there where you see more sushi than table.
Yeah. Well, that's for another podcast.
Oh, I'm hungry too.
All right, gang. Well, sounds like you guys are working on some really great stuff.
What you working on, Mikey?
It's Skull Clayton. You got a bunch of projects.
Yeah,
on,
but
dude.
I can't talk about anything. Although I will say that it looks like I'm going to be directing another music video.
So oh, smoking cool. Another one.
Yeah, because I did all of Pagey's stuff and I've done some other stuff. So, and I'm kind of excited about that. I'll know next month if I got the gig because it has a little bit of a budget.
Budget's good.
Clothing optional?
Yeah, is it a current Van Nuys?
No, this is...
Wow. You're going to need a wide angle for that one.
It's actually legit.
This is actually, I hope it's legit. Well, now I'm going to ask more questions.
Yeah.
No. But no, that's kind of fun. As long, you know, I like music and stuff, but I'm also really into video.
But porn.
It's kind of cool.
You said, I like music, but.
Now, you know what? Video is really fun. We're going to have a lot of that to talk about coming up.
We should have a video cast.
Video feels a radio star.
I'll tell you one thing about video. If you have any inclination, if you've been a musician or you play drums or something, it really helps in video because video has rhythm and has a pace just like music, you know?
I love video.
I'll tell you something.
It's really fun.
Talking of video, I just bought, thanks to Rob's advice, Final Cut Express. I installed it and I went, right. I don't know how to use this. I have no clue why I have two.
But he taught me sushi, so I'm going to teach him.
Final gentlemen, may I point out that Pro Tools 8. Man, you can edit some video.
It's amazing.
You can in Cubetcha too.
You can do it in 7.
7 too.
Though.
Too. Seven, I mean, 7. I don't. For what I'm doing these tutorials, man, I haven't opened up Final Cut in about 6 months, even though I love Final Cut.
Yeah.
The best thing.
I do it all in Pro Tools.
And post-production, too, you version. Like when I'm working on a national campaign and there's a pre and a post and different versions of it, you can just line up all your video and do it.
You know what? For these A&E and National Geographic shows, they're actually making picture changes and just sending me little slivers of OMFs and new video. And the ability to just be able to take a little sliver of video. Luckily, it has a time code window burned in. I take the sliver of video, throw it onto the video track.
That's cool.
And it's great. They don't have to send me the whole project. They can just send me the little bits and pieces that they've changed.
Yeah,
and what's crazy about it is you can do sample accurate editing of the audio, which you can't do in
Final Cut.
No, that's true. And the other thing, too, is...
That's a good point.
We
should talk about
that.
We know we're going to have to do this on another podcast because it's really changed. I mean, I don't think I've done in any outside work, I haven't done a tape-based project in years.
No.
Everything
no,
is
neither
just
have
files.
We. But you know what? For international versions, they want all the stuff delivered on D88 and DAT.
Hey, I got a D88. You want to buy it?
I got four of them, luckily.
All right,
but
well,
no.
Hey, listen. We're going to have to clamp this down. Don't get me started on D88.
And we can't blame Lee anymore. We went off on our own tangent.
That was totally off. Let's go get sushi.
All right, gang. Well, hey, once again, thanks for listening. And like I said, if you want to reach us, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Or you can catch us on our Facebook or MySpace page.
He won't answer any of it.
We'll look at it. All right, for myself and all the guys, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and West Wave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaulo and uses Aphex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.